Hey folks, and welcome to Dungeon Casters, the Dungeon Master Advice Show for Rookie DMs by Rookie DMs.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Scott.
And we're going to help you... Well, we're going to talk about something different today. It's not Dungeons & Dragons.
And welcome back.
Hey, we're back from our regularly scheduled bathroom break.
Yeah, it was very satisfying. And everything came out fine, in case anyone was wondering.
I was hoping you were gonna say it.
Yeah, well, yeah. Can't trust me with that kind of stuff.
No, I can't.
To bring us back to where we were talking about, essentially, the balance between immersion and gameplay, and getting your players into the game and building a rich world for them without, you know, overwhelming them. And we were talking about, you know, the weapons that I had reskinned to be more generic and be more simple for the sake of people who do not have a large amount of, you know, knowledge about firearms. So another thing that, you know, I think is important with immersion and with the world in story building and everything is having a story that is recognizable but not a ripoff. So something that, you know, I love post-apocalyptic settings for is that you can take classic fantasy stories and classic fantasy tropes and put them in this post-apocalyptic setting, and all of a sudden it's familiar, and they're oh wait, I think I know what's going on, but it's just different enough that they're oh, this is new and exciting.
That's so true, Scott.
So it's the kind of thing where instead of having to go really in depth about the world, right? Which on a personal level I love doing, but not everyone's down for, you can use something that's vaguely familiar to the players, which can transfer over to being familiar and to the characters, and then you can kind of build this setting that way. An example I have is the stereotypical damsel in distress story, evil tower, evil wizard or witch or whoever is holding a princess at the top of it. Pulling that into another genre is literally just switching a couple adjectives. So it's true. Change out evil witch with, if you want to do it cyberpunk, evil CEO. Change out tower with skyscraper. If you want to bring it into the apocalypse, you don't even need to really change anything. It's just what the word means. Because in Little Light, there is a pseudo-magic system. It's based on the idea of genetic mutations, telekinesis, pyrokinesis, and what I call psychokinesis, which is essentially just being able to manipulate people's minds and thoughts. And so someone who is a practitioner of those mutations and does that in Little Light is called a witch, spelled with a Y, because it's the apocalypse.
Because it's the apocalypse, and no one can spell anymore, because grammar schools are gone.
Grammar schools are gone. Everything is spelled phonetically, especially Anchorage, which is really funny. A lot of the big settings, settlements in the world, are built on the ruins of previous settlements in large cities.
Sure.
So, Anchorage, Alaska, San Antonio, Texas, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, New York, all these places have settlements built on them, and some of them, because they were, you know, relatively preserved to the apocalypse, have almost the same name. It's just gotten to the point where it's just spelled phonetically now.
Yeah. I that. That's a good touch.
It's fun, because when your players are carrying, and they see that, you know, they're going through, and they see, oh, this is the place we're going to, and they see how it's spelled, and they're what the hell is this place? And then they sound it out, and they're this is fucking L.A. We're going to L.A. It's just spelled like an idiot wrote it. And I'm yeah, isn't that fun?
Isn't it fun?
So,
that's a good idea. I really like that.
So, like, witch is with a Y, but it has similar connotations. So, you can take those kind of tropes that your players, especially if you're pulling a party that's, you know, familiar with D&D into this game, you can take those tropes that they're familiar with from the high fantasy setting and just kind of reskin them and kind of bring that immersion in a fun, kind of different way.
Yeah, and that's true of any kind of storytelling. And I know that this is a kind of running problem among people who want to tell stories. Now, this is I mean, I'm a writer, so I'm around this kind of all the time, but dungeon masters are essentially people who are going to tell long-form improvisational story, right? Mm-hmm. Like, kind of this weird improvisational play is what they're doing. And so I know that there's a lot of anxiety on my end, and so I'm sure there's a lot of anxiety on a lot of people's ends about feeling like you're ripping off an idea and that it's not good because it's so derivative and people won't find it fun because they'll just go like, oh, this is just this. You've just given me this. This is just, you know, whatever movie, you know, insert X, Y, Z television show or book.
Men in Black,
like I did, right? And yeah, there's a moment of like, this is going to be, someone's going to recognize it, right? Someone always is going to recognize it. And you can hope that they find that fun and exciting. Like, oh, I know, I love this thing. Like, well, this is going to be great. You know, but there's always going to be people who say like, oh, this is just this. And that can be very demoralizing. But I think it's important to remember, as somebody who is running games and possibly making games, that even the best told stories are kind of variations on stories that have already been told. I mean, there's only, you know, human experience changes all the time as like we get new technologies and language changes and the world sort of adapts to different things. But, you know, like that sort of the hero's journey and the stranger comes to town, like those are pretty much all we got on the whole in terms of at least traditional storytelling. So, you know, Scott's saying, you know, take, you know, whatever movie, Mad Max or something. And, you know, there you are, take your damsel in distress and be like, you know, but, and that seems kind of like, oh, that's just a reskin. But I mean, when you break that down, all you're talking about is someone's been kidnapped, get them back. Like, that is so fundamental in its story premise that you can put anything on top of that. And even the most complicated stories usually boil down to something like that. Now, of course, you can, like, go wholesale and just say, like, oh, but there's, like, this thing that's kind of slimy and has an extending mouth and it impregnates you with its babies and they come out of your chest. You're like, well, all right. Like, maybe. But even something like Alien, as I was talking about with another friend of ours, is really just a bunch of other science fiction movies mashed into one science fiction movie that's done really well. So, yeah. You know, don't be embarrassed or ashamed or nervous, if you can help it, about taking something that really excites you topically or thematically or narratively and reskinning it into something else. Now, if that's you end up picking up whatever version of Little Light Scott ultimately publishes online, it's like, oh, I want to do this, but I want to do it here. Or whatever game you pick up, or just in your Dungeons & Dragons campaign, you've said like, oh, I just watched, like, I don't know, because it's new, you know, like, the Marvel movies, like, you know, the Infinity War, or whatever it was, and I want to, like, do something like that. Like, you know, make it different, but you're allowed to tell a story about, like, a big threat that comes down with kind of murky intentions, and people have to get together to solve the problem. I mean, that's, like, if that's not the fundamental premise of every D&D campaign, I don't really know what is.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's just one of those things I think it's more about getting used to the idea that that's what storytelling is. And go back to any of your favorite stories, any of your favorite movies, and, like, break them down to their barest components, and you will find essentially the same story at the bottom. But somehow, it's still interesting. So yeah. You can do that kind of reskinning, and oftentimes that's where the best ideas come from. Because you don't want to alienate people. It comes back to that. People... especially if you're going to give them, like, a very sort of specific genre-oriented setting that's not the real world, it's not realism, then it's important that you give them that foothold of, like, oh, I recognize this. I don't know where I am exactly, but I do know what to do.
Now, I have fallen victim to this pretty significantly, as I'm going to first stipulate this with the fact that there does exist a Fallout RPG. There is pen and paper RPG. Now, that being said, and we both know this information, all the listeners now know this information, my game has been called by people that have seen it and played it, oh, Fallout the pen and paper. Right. Now, whenever people say that, it wounds me on a deep level that I have never shared or shown with them, and I hide it very well.
Yeah.
But, like, it wounds me on a deep level. And at first, I didn't understand why. And to understand why, I'm going to tell you guys a little bit about where I got the name for Little Light. So, my initial idea was the apocalypse was foreseen, and there were these giant missile silo-shaped underground cities with a big glass, like, biodome over the top, built in preparation for saving as much of the populace as possible.
I forgot about that.
Right? And they were called Big Lights, because there was a big lighthouse on the top, in the idea that if there is anyone wandering this apocalyptic wasteland, they would be able to follow the light and, you know, get to safety in a civilization. The name Little Light comes from all of the other surface settlements that have, you know, come about of people who didn't want to live in the big lights. And so they choose to live, they're essentially like frontier-y, pioneer-type people, right? Mm-hmm. And so their settlements, they had small lighthouses in them, and they were called Little Lights. And that's where the name of the game comes, because originally there was there's a conflict, like a giant, essentially the second American Civil War going on in the apocalypse, and you played as specifically deserters from one side or the other, and like that has since changed, and it's a lot more vague. It's still a part of one of the settlements, but it's not like a crucial part of the game. And so you were, you know, going around being mercenaries in Little Lights, and thus the name of the game. Now, someone at one point pointed out to me how Big Lights are literally the exact same fucking thing as a vault from Fallout. And I was just like, oh no. And I was like, the only difference was like, mine were vertical instead of horizontal.
Right.
And mine had much larger populations than the vaults did. But like, other than that, it was the same fucking premise. Yeah. And I was just like, okay, so, sure, as Ben and I were saying, you can reskin or borrow ideas or kind of rehash ideas and stuff like that, but my game was literally shaping up to just be Fallout. And that already exists, and that's not what I was intending. So yeah. I have since eliminated the concept of Big Lights. They are not in the game anymore. There's no subterranean missile silo settlements anywhere. But the name, as I was saying before, stuck. I tried to switch it to Lantern Light, and that didn't work. No one would call it Lantern Light.
No Little Light's charming. I don't know. It's got a ring to it.
So due to that, the settlements throughout the apocalyptic wasteland still have lighthouses, and they're still called Little Lights, because they're like little lights of civilization left in the apocalypse. That's, you know, tagline and all that kind of stuff. So I got into trouble, well, not into trouble, but, like, I got wrapped up in the idea of I had this really cool concept, and, like, I didn't really question where it came from. And where it came from was playing Fallout, you know? It was, like, literally, like, my brain just twisted an idea that I already knew 90 degrees, so it was vertical, and it was just like, this is a whole new individual thing! And it wasn't. It was the same fucking thing as Fallout. So it's important to, you know, have a balance there and understand that you have to be wary of, like, I mean, big, bad, scary copyright lawyers, but also, like, yes, reskinning Men in Black into a fantasy kind of setting was what the original premise of your campaign was, but we did not follow the plot of Men in Black at all.
Yeah, I mean, really, I just was like, I want an organization that's like, because I think the trouble with this kind of thing is that, like, a good idea that you've seen, Fallout, Men in Black, is not a good idea just because it's cool, like, aesthetically. It's a good idea because it makes a tremendous amount of intuitive sense at a human level. Like, Men in Black makes sense because it's like, well, there are government agencies that are secretive. We all sort of are suspicious that they're, like, handling aliens. You know, like, there's a way in which, it's so clean an idea. And with Fallout, it's the same. It's like, well, people make Fallout shelters. Like, the underground bunker isn't a stretch of the imagination at all. It's just bigger. And the idea that people wouldn't conduct, like, psychological experiments is like, yeah, they probably would.
Of course they would, because people are horrible. Like, of course that's what would happen.
So you end up in this tricky situation of, like, you know, no idea is perfect and anything can happen. But it's sometimes people just kind of hit the nail on the head and you're like, that is probably what we would do. So what do I do with that? So, you know, how do you get around if there's a threat of nuclear apocalypse, people would build Fallout shelters? It's like, well, not only would they've already done it. Like, you know, this
human
is not,
beings exist with this shit in their backyard.
Yeah, so you do end up with that trouble sometimes of, like, I want to throw a different sort of thing out in the water, but it kind of seems like that's the logical thing's already, somebody's thought of it. And I think the way out is, you recognize that, like, you know, if you're writing a story that's in modern times and you're like, I want them to go to the moon, it's like, you're going to be using rocket ships. Like, you're going to be using rocket ships. Like, that is what you're going to be using. Like, that's it, right? But you look at the stories around that and you say, like, well, what if I did this differently? You start changing little pieces until, like Scott said in our campaign, like, I mean, the Men in Black part was really just a device to get the sort of story moving, but it was mostly just kind of a vehicle for getting them from place to place. And it was just a kind of, it was just there. And I was upfront about it. You know, I was like, yeah, this is what this is. Just, like, ignore it, basically. But except that there are some things that human beings do, because that's what we've done. That's, like, our inclination for whatever reason. But then underplay that element to then play up the elements that are unique to your idea. You know, don't dwell on the stuff that you think is derivative for too long, because people will accept a little bit of just like, oh, that's kind of like this, but they don't want to just do the same thing that, it, you know, they don't want to repeat the source material, essentially.
Yes. Well, yeah, and that's the thing, is like, that's why I changed the, like, I took out the big lights. That's why I changed it, because, like, the plot of the Fallout games is, like, leave your vault for reason X, Y, or Z, help the locals, kill a bunch of mutants, like, whoa! And, like, that was the fucking game I made. And I was just like, okay, so this is not only, like, you know, ripping off their large bomb shelter idea, but also, like, completely ripping off the, like, bread and butter plot to their games.
Mm-hmm.
So I switched things around, and, like, the big, that actually brought, through, like, a series of hoops and stuff, brought about the idea of, like, me developing this world as an option. So, as I said, the game is vague. The game does not have, you know, specifics of the apocalypse or specifics of, you know, anything really. But I have developed, like, it's essentially like a supplement book to the rule book. So, as I said previously, the rule book's dry and boring. I try to, like, make the wording a little bit more fun and readable, and it is, like, a little bit more casual in tone than, like, you know, the instruction manual for your blender, but it's still just, like, stats, factoids, and rules. So I have a second book that's just, like, lore and the world. And essentially, Washington, D.C. is where the Cataclysm's epicenter was. The Cataclysm being the ubiquitous event that ended the world.
Right.
And as a result of that cataclysm, there is something called ether radiation, which affects the world in a bunch of different ways. The further away you get from it, the less there's an effect. So, like, you go to Mexico, the depths of northern Canada, or, like, California, and there is little to no effect from the ether. But all along the East Coast, it's like heavily radiated. So the area around Washington, D.C. is basically just like a zombie apocalypse wasteland. And then you go down to like the Florida Gulf Coast area, and it's like these really overgrown swamps, and there are all these mutants with like telekinetic powers. And then the further away you go, the less supernatural the apocalypse gets, so to speak. But it still does, you know, kind of influence in ways.
Sure.
So, although I started with ripping off Fallout, and as soon as that was drawn to my attention, it pulled me in a new direction, where now I have a very rich, detailed world that I have built because out of, like, necessity. Like, I needed a better, richer story, and that was, you know, draft number two.
Right.
And, like, there's a lot of really neat things that came from the idea of not having these, like, government-run shelters. So, the big one being, like, alright, so the government was unprepared for this. There was not these big shelters made. This, you know, blindsided everyone. Who would have done okay in the event of an apocalypse? And I had this, like, weird idea that, you know, there are these cartels, right? Drug cartels from, you know, South America that have these, like, compounds deep in the middle of, like, the South American and Central American jungles where they have these heavily fortified, armed, and, like, guarded fortresses with these large agricultural fields growing drugs.
Right.
Now, they are isolated, so they would not be affected by, you know, any kind of cataclysm that affects big cities. They have the means to produce food and supplies, they have the arms to protect it, and they have the resources to grow. So the idea is, like, Mexico in the, you know, world I'm building is the superpower, because the 400 years down the line, descendants of these cartel bosses have essentially recreated a feudal system in Mexico with the resources they started with, and done incredibly well for the apocalypse, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so Mexico is like, each kind of region is a little bit kind of a different themed apocalypse, where you have the place around DC being like the real zombie one. Mexico is more of a dystopian kind of cyberpunk future one, because they've had years and years and years of just development. So they are, you know, much more advanced than anywhere else. They have these huge cities. They have this futuristic technology. They've actually taken this ether radiation and harnessed it into, like, a sci-fi, you know, plasma kind of energy thing, mm-hmm. where, like, they have these, like, essentially laser weapons based on it and stuff like that. So it's the kind of thing where, like, that idea was spawned from the necessity to eliminate something that was close to another plot of a game in my game. So I think that, like, it's pretty neat to be able to revisit and kind of be like, this all stemmed from, like, a random idea I had when I was panicking and trying to redesign my entire game.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, too, this brings up an important lesson about, you don't get it right the first time very often, no. You know? And
Six years.
And, you know, you didn't do probably as much playtesting as you wanted to, because it was hard to get groups together a lot of times, but you did a pretty good amount of playtesting. Like, you playtested at least a couple times per version. And like you said, you're on, like, version 6 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember playing a version years ago.
That was, like, version 2.
Yeah, that had some of the elements. Like, when I read, because you sent me the rule book some time ago, there within, like, the last year, and I read it, and I was like, oh, I remember this. But I don't remember, like, any of this,
mm-hmm.
you know, so there were substantial changes, and so I guess I do want to talk about, so, like, now you've been talking about how you've kind of been making it more and more vague in versions that sort of superseded previous versions. Like, every version kind of gets a little maybe wishy-washy with, like, the specifics.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of story and stuff like that. So I think it's hard for DMs sometimes to give up any amount of control over their game, you know? Like, it's a thing that you built this thing, you have this cool story, you want to tell it this way, this is what happened. And anytime, and it will happen, the players sort of do something that diverts from that path, it can be very frustrating. And you're like, I don't really know what to do. So I can only imagine that at a creation of a game level, it's even more nerve-wracking to be like, I'm going to put this forward, and I have no idea. Because not only are players going to do what they want, I now have GMs who are going to take whatever I did and do whatever they want.
Well,
and
exactly.
Who knows?
And this is the thing, is like, as I had this, that's why the original iteration had a, like, full storyline of the game written in. It was like a board game, because there was a plot already built into the rule book. And that was me designing the game as a GM, because I was like, this is what I would run. And as it's gone on, I've stopped thinking of it as a GM and had to learn to think of it as a game designer, where as opposed to, you know, using rules and using barriers to kind of guide the narrative, I have to, like, eliminate rules and eliminate barriers so that a GM can build a narrative. So it's kind of like an inverse thought process, because what I'm used to is being a DM or a GM, and I'm used to running the show. And what I now have to be used to when I'm designing this game is giving someone else the resources to run the show.
Right. I remember recently I was watching, there's a YouTube channel called D&D Beyond. I think it's like a Wizards of the Coast run YouTube channel, where the creators, you know, Chris Perkins and, Mike Merles and Jeremy Crawford, I think his name is, will talk about every time they produce like a new supplement or they put out like an Unearthed Arcana online or something, they'll, over some things, they'll do a small kind of interview explaining the process of making it and why they did it and why they're excited about it and so on. And Chris Perkins, who's like the sort of world's DM at this point, he was talking about the process of making campaigns for publication in their magazine, right? Because that's something they've been doing, Wizards of the Coast has been doing for years and years and years, is you can submit campaigns, and if they're good, they will publish them so other DMs can take them and use them in their games. And he said the trickiest thing about it is you have to give specific goals with really vague means of achieving those goals. And you have to be specific enough that the players will want to participate in the adventure, but vague enough that the DM can do whatever they want and need to with the adventure. And I remember thinking, like, he's explaining it in such a simple way that it can only be nightmarishly difficult to accomplish. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's, he's been doing this for years, and they still have trouble putting this kind of stuff out, because it is a real challenge. And I don't know, it was always just, I remember listening to you kind of talk about running the game and playing the game and figuring out the game and just thinking, like, this sounds so hard. And you always, like, knew what the problems were, but the solutions of just, like, like, we would have phone conversations about, like, the one we had recently, I remember being, like, the difference, like, how large an impact would it be to reduce, like, a monster's defense by, like, 1 point?
Yeah.
And, like, the huge implications that would have on the rest of the system. Because all of a sudden, everything was scaled at a different level if this was slightly easier to hit.
And that's been one of my biggest problems. I want to talk about that later, is designing monsters is, like, the hardest fucking part of this. like, I have so much respect to these dudes that, like, design the monsters now and, like, build the stats and level them and everything, because that shit is so fucking exhausting. But, like, because I'm using six-sided dies and a single six-sided die, there's no, like, roll 2d6. It's always 1d6. So it's always on a scale of 1 to 6, making, and, like, plus or minus your stats. So the average stat is, like, a 3. So that means, like, a high roll is a 9, a low roll is a 1, and a medium, or a low roll is a 3, and a medium roll is a 6. So it's all single-digit numbers.
Yeah.
So that being said, like, moving from a 7 to an 8 is a very significant difference in an enemy. And, like, it's been, tweaking it has been so hard because you, like, tweak one thing. You're like, oh, I'll just toss it up a point or two. And all of a sudden, it's just, like, ridiculous. Like, there was one iteration I played. We ran a full one-shot session. And I did not hit the players once with the enemies. And I gave them hard combats that were supposed to kill them, and they dodged every single bullet I shot at them, and every bullet they shot, one kill. One kill.
God.
They put everyone down. It was like Neo from The Matrix fighting like Paul Blart Mall Cop, right? So it was like unbelievable. They were unstoppable. And like, I mean, they had a blast because it was
like kicking ass.
It was like basically they had God mode on.
Yeah.
And like the next iteration, I was like, all right, so I gotta change this. And I eliminated like four stats that got added into all these roles they were doing. And I made it so it's just like really simple. And all of a sudden, like, no one was hitting anything. Enemies were clawing people to shreds and everyone was missing every attack. And that was actually, most recently, we had a phone call, and that was my issue, is I talked earlier about how weapons have a proficiency and you have to unlock it. Now, every weapon has two scores, and they essentially water down to accuracy and damage. They have different names depending on the type of weapon and all that kind of stuff, but it's two scores for every weapon, an accuracy score and a damage score. And so, the way I had it set up was, if you are not proficient with a weapon, you do not use its accuracy score. You just use, you know, your basic moxie score.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, if you're not proficient in a weapon, you never hit. It's impossible to hit. It's exhaustingly difficult to hit something. And damage, if you do hit, you still do like massive amounts of damage because you still use the weapon's damage score. So
right.
If you're really low level and you find a high level weapon, you will never hit an enemy once with it. But in the rare chance that you do, you will demolish that enemy. So, like, in my mind, I was like, oh, that's how it should be. Because that way, you know, if you risk the pros and cons in the sense of, like, oh, well, I'll never hit, but if I do, I'll take him down. And I had a player that was very frustrated with that. And I was, like, racking my brain. And that's where changing, you know, the monster skills came into play, where I was like, oh, do I lower their defense? But then I have to lower everyone's defense. I have to rebalance the entire, like, you know, monster bestiary and everything. And, like, holy shit, this is so much work. And it turned out it was the simplest solution I've ever thought of in my entire life. I just switched it. I switched damage and accuracy. So now, if you're not proficient with a weapon, you still get the accuracy score. You don't get the damage bonuses. You just have a base damage. And that, and if you're proficient, you get the, like, damage bonuses. So this way, if you're not trained in a weapon, you'll hit, but it will hit really weakly.
Yeah, this was...
So you get the satisfaction
of
hitting, but it just won't be broken and be doing massive amounts of damage.
Yeah, this is very much, like, where the, at the end of the day, it's a game comes in.
Yes.
Because... like, does that sound intuitively backwards? Like, yeah, it does.
A little bit.
Like it shouldn't do less, like, but you, like, it really should be that you wouldn't be able to hit with it because you have no idea how this thing works, you can't handle the recoil, you don't know how to aim it, you don't know its range, you don't know its spread, you know, all those things. But if you hit it would hurt the same, which in real life is true. But in the sense of it's a game, it's important to remember what players want. And really, players want to feel like what they did happened. You know, like, if they want to shoot something, they want to shoot it. They don't want to miss 13 times in a row on the off chance that they'll peg it for really good damage. Maybe in, like, a, I don't know, a real firefight in some way, that's the better option. I don't know, probably not. But in a game, people want to succeed. And I think that the answer just became, like, they just are succeeding at a lower level because they're not good with it. But there's still, like you said, there is a satisfaction of being like, good, I connected. I didn't do a lot, but what I wanted to do, I accomplished. And that sense of accomplishment is kind of what people want out of the game, is that if they can't get the big one, they'll get the small sense of accomplishment. They will take, like, I participated. over, yes. I spent the entire combat doing nothing of consequence. That sucks. Exactly. That's a terrible feeling. So
it is. And so that was, you know, on a designer side, that was my issue to overcome. And I was like, honestly, the point of the game, right, is to make something that's fun, something that's enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And like, realism be damned, I want it to be more fun than realistic.
Mm-hmm.
I do want a game grounded in realism. That's why the wound system and the health system is so unfucking forgiving. But at the same time, I do want people to be able to enjoy playing it. Like, I don't want to make Dark Souls in the Apocalypse, the board game, because that's fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
So, the idea that, like, you do the simpler instant gratification that's going to make the player psychologically feel better, even if it's no more effective or helpful. Like, hitting really weakly 10 times and hitting really strongly 1 time after missing 9 accomplishes the same thing, but one of them is a lot more gratifying than the other.
Yeah, I mean, it's very true. And I mean, from a design standpoint, is that's your bread and butter, right? Is like, is the game constantly engaging, and does it give you something back for playing it?
And, exactly.
And yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for a really hard fight that you just squeak out of. Like, of course, there's something to be said for just making it through. That's very exciting. But you also have to consider, like, if you're trying to play out the movie of your game in your mind, and, you know, you think of like a car chase sequence, and like they fire like 12 bullets and they don't even like break the windshield, you're like, well, I guess we've got a couple of idiots in these cars, like, can't hit the broadside of a barn. You know, there's something very anticlimactic about not connecting with anything. Or not even remotely accomplishing a goal, even if, like, potentially you could down the line. So, that is one of those things that I encounter as a DM, too. It's, like, the idea, I'm more and more coming around to the idea of, like, people not missing what they, like, they, even if they don't hit, you know, you shoot a fireball spell, Dungeons and Dragons again. You shoot a fireball spell and it's like got explosive radius or something, but it doesn't hit anybody. It misses. When you describe it, you don't necessarily say it missed so much as like it did, like, you know, it landed where you wanted it, but they were dodged out of the way. And maybe what that means is the enemies are now in different locations than where they started. So they at least like displaced somebody. Or you describe like minor damage that doesn't necessarily correlate to like actual hit point damage, but like, you know, you singe their clothes, you can see like they've got some burns on them, but they managed to get out of the way. That at least has some sense of like you've caused some havoc, you've displaced the enemy, you have, you know. And then it's on the DM to decide whether or not you want to start really role playing out like, well, now they know you have this spell, the game has changed, now they're in hiding, now they're coming for you. You know, there's all these kinds of things to play out, but giving the player nothing, just like, you missed, next turn, is kind of like, I mean, think of any board game you've ever played where you just like get like a go back to square spaces and you're like, oh, well, fuck this turn, this game sucks. You know, I mean, it's that feeling. It's just, you don't need to succeed, but you don't want to go, like, you don't want to feel like you're going backwards or being completely ineffectual.
Exactly. And that's why, like, the idea of like, oh, your sword connected, but it glanced off their pauldron, or they raised their buckler just in time, and it clang, and it knocks it off to the side, or, like, right as you release the bowstring, sweat drips into your eyes, and you, you know, like, pulling in outside world influence to explain the miss or the fuck-up is also really important in the same regard, as opposed to, like, oh no, you just suck and you missed. It's very different than like, you know, like a wind blows and like your hair tickles the side of your face right as you release the bowstring, and that distracts you and you raise your hand up to itch your ear and that makes the bow, you know, tweak or something like that. And that's why you missed. So that's like, oh, it's not that I'm bad at doing this. It's that the wind blew. So like, fuck the wind, right?
Yeah, fuck the wind, dude. And I think it's an important part of running a sort of compelling game is not saying you just missed, like, oh, I just whiffed my shot. But like you said, with the glances off the pauldrons or glances off the shield, the player then understands why they were ineffective. So even if it's a net zero gain on, like, damage done, they're like, ah, the trouble is I can't get past this person's shield. If I take the shield away, maybe I'll hit. Just saying you missed is like, oh, they're just... I missed because I'm a goof. Like, you know, it doesn't really help the player solve a problem. You know, because if they can't hit, it's because of, in Dungeons & Dragons, it's AC. Or in your game, it's because of, like, their grit score. Or whatever score they're using to dodge, maybe skill or something. So saying, like, oh, they're, like, really nimble-footed. It's like, ah, maybe if I get them in a corner or I set some kind of trap, I can navigate around the problem of not being able to hit. You know, and I think that sort of leading the person to understand why they're having difficulty is also, I don't consider that as a player, like, just a failure that doesn't help me. It's aggravating to, like, just do zero, but to be like, ah, but now I can sort of formulate a strategy as to how to do more next time. That's important, too, and I think that...
Well, yeah, like, a prime example, right, is I recently actually started DMing again this past week.
Oh, shit,
it's been a wonderful fucking week.
It's been
a long
time.
I've been on, like, cloud nine since Sunday because I got to DM again. It's been fucking rad. But, like, we had essentially, they got in a tavern brawl, right? And one of the characters was, like, this swashbuckling rogue, and he was on one side of a table, and the guy he wanted to kill was on the other side. So, like, he's like, all right, I want to move here. And he moved, he, like, pointed directly through the table. I was like, well, how? That's a table. Like, what are you going to do? And he's like, well, I want to, like, get over it. I'm like, explain to me what you do. And I, like, forced him to be like, is he going to, like, slide down the table? Is he just going to jump over it? Is he going to flip? Like, and he ended up being like, oh, I want to, like, do some, like, front handspring flippy shit over it. And I was like, all right, cool, swashbuckly. He got a 20 on the acrobatics roll to get over the table, which was awesome. And then he attacked the guy and rolled a critical 1 on the attack.
No.
So, like, if I had just described his, like, dope-ass 3-point landing front handspring, and then it was just like, oh, yeah, you missed.
And then you farted the landing.
Yeah, so that would have sucked. So what I did was, he stuck the landing, but he just happened to stick one of his feet in the landing in a bowl of, like, porridge that was on the table. And so when he went to extend to stab, his foot slipped out, and he did, like, a quick split, and it made him miss. So it's like, the flip was flawless, the landing was excellent, but the attack was fucked. And so, like, being able to describe the entire course of actions in a narrative form, as opposed to being like, oh, acrobatics check, you passed, you made it over the table, oh, so roll your attack, you beat his AC, alright, so you hit, roll damage, alright, you do this much damage.
It's very stiff.
It is, but if I'm like, so you flipped over the table, planting one hand on the edge, landing in a 3-point landing, you brandish your rapier above your head and stab directly towards his face, but you feel your foot give way, and as you look down, you see it stuck in a bowl of soup, and it splits off to the other side. You feel a sharp tear in between your legs, and you know you're not going to recover from this quickly as your rapier glances off to the side. All of a sudden, that was an immersive experience as opposed to a mathematical experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Dungeons & Dragons can sometimes reduce to, is a mathematical experience, and that's unfortunate. And I think that because there's so many numbers, and in Little Light, there feels like there's less numbers. There might not necessarily be less numbers, but I think the sort of smallness means they're all very, like, oh, it's, like, somewhere between, like, a 6 and a 7. You know, it's, like, not that big a deal. Scott, before I have to leave. I have to start getting ready for work in about 10 minutes. So is there anything you want to say before I have to go and cut this short?
Okay, well, I do want to actually, upon the point you were just talking about, is, like, the lower numbers do also help with immersion and, you know, making it less of a math simulator. And the other thing is, there's an aspect of the game that I picked up from, actually, Mansions of Madness.
Mm. It's a board game based on the Cthulhu mythos, if you haven't played it.
I'm honestly, if you're listening to our podcast, you probably know what Mansions of Men.
Yeah, it's probably.
It's a pretty fucking big game.
Yeah, it's in your lexicon, I imagine. But in case.
But in case, game. Yes. It's a very cool board game. It's essentially Clue with a modular board and Cthulhu Mythos.
Yeah.
So, like, they have puzzles in the game. And the puzzles are literally, like, card, like little modular like puzzle pieces that you have to shuffle around based on your stats like actually like physically literally solve a puzzle in order to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was like a really fucking cool concept because like in Dungeons and Dragons, if you're gonna pick a lock, it's like, all right, roll the d20. If you beat this number, you picked the lock. But like, you don't get a sense of an accomplishment. You just get like the same sense of accomplishment as like, oh, do you want to jump over this river? Do you want to climb this log? Do you want to lie to this person? But, like, solving a puzzle is a different kind of feeling. So I built systems for not only picking locks, but hacking computers, surviving storms, and having conversations with people that are all, like, essentially logic puzzles or different kinds of puzzles that you have to, you know, solve in order to do this. So, like,
yeah.
Hacking computers is essentially Hangman,
mm-hmm.
right? And so there are all these cool different puzzles, like picking locks is a kind of, like, numbers-based dice-rolling puzzle. Talking to people is a... like, pro-con, your favor, balancing your questions, reward, consequence kind of puzzle. Storms is like a fit the shelter to the situation kind of puzzle. So, like, there's all these built-in puzzles that on the GM side are really complex and you have to pre-build because you cannot pull this stuff out of your ass.
No.
It has to be, like, built ahead of time. But if you do have them ready, all of a sudden are, like, a lot more fun because instead of it being, like, oh, I want to try to break into this door and pick this lock. It's like, okay, cool. Well, start rolling dice, and you have to do it tumbler by tumbler, and there's a sweet spot, and you have to hit the right number, and if you don't have the right skill to do it, you're not going to succeed. And then if you fuck up, this lock is now jammed and broken, so how are you going to get in this door now?
Yeah. I think that the thing I want to say about this game is I've only played it, like, once. It was a long time ago, but I've talked to you a lot about it, and I'm very engaged with the idea of it. I'm very engaged with the mechanics of it, and I think the thing that, for me, kind of excites me about it, aside from also liking the theme, is that there seems to be... there's a sense of, like, weight to things in the game that, in Dungeons & Dragons, I feel like can be very easily sort of lost. There's something about, like, how high fantasy, like, traditional Dungeons & Dragons is, that it can be very difficult to impose any kind of weight into it. Now, some people don't care. Some people like that it can be so lofty. Like, I don't die! You know?
Yes.
But if you're ever interested in putting on something that is got more consequence and you want to instill more sort of fear or anxiety or concern, it can be a little tricky to do in the game because everyone's really pretty strong and it's not that crazy to bring people back from the dead and so on and so forth. But with Little Light, what's been cool is, like, it's almost like you're just about scraping by every time you succeed. You know,
exactly.
It's like, so it's not for everybody because it can be very, like, high stress, because you do have to be like, no. Like, we get one shot. We don't fuck this up. What are we going to do?
I have 6 bullets in my gun, and I've not seen a bullet for this gun in 4 weeks. So, no, we're not going to fight these guys.
Yeah, so it's a game that calls for a little more contemplation, a little more smart thinking, more pre-planning. It's probably a game that... I think there's moments, I'm sure, there's moments that are kind of these bursts of action. But I imagine I would play it more like, all right, like, I want to know how we're handling this problem before we jump into it. For me, that's a very satisfying kind of game. I really like that sort of contemplative thing. Not everybody's into it. That's what it is. And I like to the sort of the mechanically how things boil down into a very few number of components, just like a couple ability scores and some skills. Because even though this was a long time ago and it was second edition for you and it has changed significantly since then. I remember when I played it the first time and I played it with one of our friends. It was like two of us versus this game. And we got like almost instantly slaughtered. I ended up playing a surgeon, like a doctor. And I remember, we played it again too, didn't we? With Alex, yeah. But this was a while ago. And Scott put us in this situation where we were brought to like some sort of outpost. And somebody was basically they had a bunch of people who were like injured and sick and somebody was like giving birth and it was like a big fucking mess. And he was like, what are you going to do? Like, and I didn't have I'm going to roll my like deliver baby skill. I didn't have that. Right. So it was on me to decide. Like I had like three or four patients that I could help. And I only had like a limited number of tries to do it. And I had to come up with something like that would work. I couldn't just be like, oh, I'm going to use medicine. I'm going to use a heal skill and just like do it. You know, you were like, what are you going to do? And I think in that way, like when you pick a type of character in that game, like you have to kind of be willing to say like, I think I can handle the knowledge base needed for this. Yes. It's not necessary with everything, but like, in playing a doctor, you know, I think in like a combat setting, like just being like, oh, I'm going to like bandage the wound is enough. But like in a role playing, it was like, I got somebody who's lost a leg and I sort of was like, get me a frying pan and make it really hot. I'm going to cauterize this. That wasn't like a skill. That was just like, I'm playing a doctor. I have to come up with a way that's like feasible. And I found that very exciting because it's really kind of a great imaginative stretch. And I just enjoyed that a lot. So I think the joy of it is for me, and hopefully for anybody who plays it whenever it does get published, wherever you do that, is that it's a game that requires a little bit more of you. But for me, I think that only leads to a much more sort of like, you become very attached to your character because you're really like, I have to figure this out. Like I have these skills, I have to know. And it's more like, you know, it's not like a series of small, well, no, it is a series of small little puzzles that you have to solve, and then you're just solving this like building of like more puzzles that are just like, how do we get out of this, you know?
It's a lot more of a survival based game rather than a heroic deeds based game, because like a lot of the times when I run it, the rewards for these like quests or missions or whatever you want to call them that you go on are like, yeah, here's like 3 days worth of food and water. And it's like, great. So now your guys aren't going to die in the next 3 days, food and water wise.
Yeah.
But like, you still have to, like, it's not like you ever really get ahead in the game. It's always just like a survival aspect, which is why like it's a crucial part of the game. It's like surviving. And like, there's a whole system for food, water, and drink and sleeping that like, I mean, it's real bare bones and simplified and stuff, but it's still there, and so it's less of a, like, we're amassing a treasure hoard and we're going to become gods when we hit level 20. It's more of just, like, one more day.
I hope I make
it
to age 20.
Yeah, it's like one more day. I just got one more day is what I want right now.
I mean, to bring it back to the beginning, I mean, think about the plot of, like, the Road Warrior. Like, that's just, like, a guy trying to get some gas.
Exactly.
That's what that
all
is.
All he wanted. He just wanted someone to fill his tank.
He just wanted somebody to fill his tank. All right, Scott, it is 2:00. I have to start getting ready for work. So, I don't know. We'll see. We'll have to talk about whether we're going to split this in two or just make it one very long episode, because it's about 2 hours right now.
Yeah.
Cool. So if anybody has any questions about the game, if anybody has any questions about making their own game, you can always send us an email at dungeoncasters@gmail.com. Is it dungeoncasters@gmail.com or dungeoncasterspodcast@gmail.com? It's been so damn long.
We'll get back to you on that.
I think it's dungeoncasters@gmail.com.
I think you're right. And then if you want to tweet at us or check us out on Twitter, we have been super inactive for the last 8 months.
Silent.
absolutely nothing. But that's going to change, hopefully. We're going to start tweeting again.
Yeah.
That is dungeon_casters on
Twitter.
That's
us.
That's us. we don't have an Instagram or a Facebook or anything like that.
No, we don't. Maybe we should get one, but I haven't really mustered the energy to start like tracking down Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing game based stuff on Instagram. But yeah, so here's hoping that we can keep this going. We'll do our best. I'm hoping we can keep scheduling this. I'm off for the summer, so this is the best chance we've got, and maybe we can backlog some episodes so that there's at least some content that'll come out semi-regularly. Otherwise, thanks everybody for sticking around. Thanks for all the listens in this, all this tremendous downtime.
Yeah.
And we're happy to be back, and we'll try to bring you some other content. Oh, before we go, I wanted to say, I mentioned in my little sort of mini thing a month back that we were going to try to do, I want to try to do more sort of freewheeling conversational stuff. So whatever comes to mind, now that Scott's DMing again, we can talk about that. I'd like to talk about the campaign I'm running, though none of my players can listen. If anybody's listening to this, you're not allowed to hear any episode. I'll mark it so you know, you little cheaters. And, because there's been some interesting things with that. I want to be able to talk about other games too. That would be nice.
Yeah, we can start branching out. See like what else the world has to offer us.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot.
Yeah, and you know, I know some people wanted us to talk about like Unearth Arcana stuff, which we can do.
Which I'm 100% down.
There's a lot of it now. There's a lot of it now, and they keep releasing books, so there's a lot of material. So that's some stuff for the future.
Hey, Ben.
Oh my god, I didn't think you'd have one.
Hey, Ben.
Yeah.
Hey, Ben.
Yeah. It feels good. I have to say, it kind of feels good to hear this again.
I would tell you a joke about the apocalypse, but are we getting too old for this?
That's so... is that a joke?
I don't know. It was the quickest one I could find because I did not prepare one.
Very good. All right, everybody.
Aren't I getting too old for this?
Yeah, I am. I'm too old for you.
In this podcast, we used Achilles and News Sting by Kevin MacLeod of Accompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons.